talked about how you could compress some source of information that had some redundancy in it. And the way we would quantify that redundancy would be in terms of the entropy of the source. So, you know, if we had some IID source, we could think about, you know, what is the entropy H of P of the distribution that describes the, you know, how each of the symbols appears. And so what the, you know, what the noiseless coding theorem says is that, well, basically that you can compress the source reliably, meaning that you're not going to make an error in the decompression, provided you try to encode at a rate which is not more than the entropy. So you can achieve rates up to the entropy, but if you try to encode at a rate which is higher than the entropy, then it's just not possible to have a reliable scheme. Okay, so this basically says really that the entropy is quantifying something important. It's quantifying how much you can compress the information. Okay, so now, you know, this was all classical, right? So this was about how we could compress some classical source, and now we want to think about how could we compress a quantum source. Okay, so let's now talk about quantum compression. Okay, so first of all, what do we mean by a quantum source? Well, let's think about the analog of an IID classical source. I mean, you could think about more general kinds of sources and what you would do in that situation, but you know, let's think about the simplest interesting case. So let's think about an IID quantum source. So this would be just a source of quantum states that, you know, outputs various different possible quantum states with different probabilities. And in general, we could even consider the case where maybe they would be mixed quantum states. So let's consider this. So we're going to have an IID quantum source, which is going to output the state rho I with probability pi. Okay, so this is the, you know, there are some signals that you might want to send. Those signals are represent quantum information, which are, you know, could be pure or possibly mixed quantum states, rho sub I. And the probability that you want to send the state rho sub I is p sub I. Okay, so now, of course, if I you know, think about the average state that's coming out of this source, well, it's described by some density matrix, and that density matrix is just the average of these states rho sub I with respect to this probability distribution p sub I. So there's an average state, which we'll write rho, which is just the sum over I of p sub I times rho sub I. Right, so that's a density matrix because it's just a convex combination of quantum states. Okay. And now the quantity which is going to be relevant, the quantity which is going to say how much we can compress this source, will be exactly the von Neumann entropy of this density matrix. Okay? So we would like to see that. So how can we see that? Well, you know, the main observation to make is that, you know, even though these states could be these states could be arbitrary, there could be a very large number of them, you know, many more than the dimension of the space in which they live. They don't necessarily have to be pure states. Nevertheless, if you think about you know, what you see when you see states coming out of a source like this, they're indistinguishable. You know, this ensemble where you see rho sub I with probability p sub I is indistinguishable from any other ensemble that's described by the same density matrix. So what we can do is we can think about actually diagonalizing the density matrix. And, you know, that describes some other ensemble. And if we could compress for that ensemble, well, we could also compress for this ensemble because these density matrices are indistinguishable. So we can diagonalize. And we can write that rho is the sum over I. Well, we already used p sub I, so let me write lambda sub I, psi sub I, psi sub I, where these psi sub I's are orthogonal pure states, so they're the eigenvectors of the density matrix rho, and the lambda sub I's form a probability distribution because the eigenvalues of a density matrix always form a probability distribution. So here's the main idea. Let's try to perform compression on this ensemble. So let's say we want to compress the ensemble where we have the state psi sub I, so where actually the pure quantum state psi sub I occurs with probability p sub I. Okay, but now notice the problem is effectively classical because these states psi sub I are orthogonal to each other. So they're actually completely distinguishable. So, you know, if we go into the basis in which the density matrix is diagonal, we're effectively compressing a classical source. Yes, Nicole?
I don't understand
Oh, sorry, just because I wrote the wrong thing. Lambda sub I. Sorry about that. Does that make more sense? Okay, good. Okay. Right, so we compress this ensemble, and this will be the same as effectively as compressing this ensemble. Okay, so now how are we going to compress this ensemble? Well, I mean, really, as I say, it's effectively a classical problem because we can just think about working in the eigenbases of rho and compressing these states. But, you know, to talk about it in a more quantum language, let's see what we would actually do to this state. I mean, so what we would like to do is only worry about transmitting typical states, right? So remember, the way the proof of this, I mean, we didn't actually see the proof, but the idea behind the classical noiseless coding theorem was that we would try to only send the typical strings, right? So there was this notion that a string is typical if it's if the number of zeros in it is close to the expectation. And you know, we saw that about all the typical strings are pretty much equally likely, and there are not too many of them. There are about 2 to the n times the entropy of the distribution if we talk about strings of length n. So we can do exactly the same thing here and talk about typical sequences of eigenvectors of rho. And we would say that you know, an eigenvector of rho tensor n, so a vector that you might want to transmit if you have n samples from this ensemble, would be typical if you know, if it corresponded to, well, now we, you know, we might have, if this thing is a qubit, then I guess we would just have 2 eigenvectors, and so we could talk about a string of bits describing which state we have. You know, more generally, we can talk about typicality in terms of you know, whether we have the type that we would expect, so the expected number of each particular eigenvector that we would see in the string. But again, there's some notion of a sequence of eigenvectors being typical. So you know, roughly speaking, so we say a sequence of eigenvectors of rho is typical if it's close to what we would expect to see. So if it's close to you know, to the expected. I mean, let's to keep things simple. Let's just imagine that each of these states is a qubit, kind of an analog to the case that we talked about most for the classical case. So then here we have some sequence of you know, psi zeros and psi ones, where psi zero and psi one are the 2 eigenvectors of rho. And let's just say it's close to the expected you know, type of eigenvector, i.e. the number of psi zeros is close to its expectation. Okay, so, and you can make this more rigorous and talk about, you know, an epsilon typical you know, sequence of eigenvectors, but I mean, we won't do that here. Okay, so now what we're going to do is we're going to perform a projection onto what we would call the typical subspace. So we can talk about, you know, whether a particular sequence of eigenvectors is typical, and then they span some subspace, which is what we would call the typical subspace. So the typical eigenvectors, the typical sequences of eigenvectors span what we would call the typical subspace. And now what can we say about the dimension of the typical subspace? I mean, roughly, we're not going to put in these epsilons, but approximately, what is the dimension of the typical subspace? So say we have, you know, we're talking about the typical subspace, so we have an n, right? Because we consider sequences of this thing of length n. And then for some large enough n, we would expect the dimension of the typical subspace to be close to, you know, something that has to do with the entropy. So what is that something? Yeah, that's right. So before it was 2 to the n times the entropy, I mean, it was the binary entropy of the distribution. Of the, you know, the, well, we just had zeros and ones, so we had a p and a 1 minus p. So it was 2 to the n times the binary entropy of that. And here we would expect to have, you know, 2 to the n times, well, the entropy of the distribution described by these lambdas. So if we just have two of them, as we're considering here, it would indeed just be 2 to the n times the binary entropy of lambda 0. And more generally, it'll just be, you know, 2 to the n times the von Neumann entropy of rho, which is, of course, just the Shannon entropy of the vector of eigenvalues of rho. Okay, so this is the dimension of the typical subspace. And so the strategy will be, let's project onto the typical subspace. And we can show that that actually won't disturb the state very much, because, you know, most of the eigenvectors that occur with pretty big probability will be typical. So all of the typical sequences of eigenvectors will have about the same probability, and that probability will make up almost all of the probability. So in other words, if we project onto the typical subspace, we'll hardly change the state at all. So the fidelity of the state that we're actually trying to send with the projection of that state onto the typical subspace will be close to 1. It'll be something that goes to 1 as n goes to infinity. So what we'll do is we'll project onto the typical subspace. And we can say that the fidelity with the true state is close to 1. And now if we project onto the typical subspace, we actually know that we're living in a subspace of the whole space whose dimension is a lot less. It's like 2 to the n times s of rho instead of the full, you know, 2 to the n, right? So this is something which is smaller than 2 to the n if the entropy is less than 1, in the case where we're talking about compressing qubits. So, you know, if that's the case, then the number of qubits that we actually need in order to send the state reliably, if we only want to send the states in the typical subspace, we just need n times s of rho qubits. Right, so then we would expect that we should be able to transmit things reliably. So with so now when we talk about quantum compression, when we say that the compression is reliable, we'll just demand that the fidelity with the state that we're trying to send is something that goes to 1 as n goes to infinity. And when we do that, we would expect that we could transmit the state using only n times s of rho qubits. In other words, s of rho should be the rate at which we can compress, just like h of p was the rate at which we could compress a classical source. So, you know, what we would do is we would say a compression scheme is reliable if the fidelity, so by the fidelity here, I mean the fidelity of the true state with the state you're actually sending, if this goes to 1 as n goes to infinity, and, you know, we would say that it has rate r. So these are just, you know, analogous definitions to what we had in the classical case. Say it has rate r if we use n times r qubits to send n qubits. In other words, we compress n qubits into only n times r qubits. Okay, so then there's an analog of this noiseless coding theorem, which is called Schumacher's quantum noiseless coding theorem. And it says the following. So, you know, we're going to consider an IID quantum source. It has entropy s of rho. So this is for the average state rho, averaged over the distribution of possible signals, you know, rho sub I that you might send with probability p sub I. So then what we can say is if you try to send at a rate which is less than the von Neumann entropy of the source, then there is a reliable compression scheme. Let me just write scheme. And if you try to send at a rate which is higher than the von Neumann entropy, then there's no reliable scheme. So any scheme must not be reliable. And this is really just a simple quantum analog of the classical the classical noiseless coding theorem, it just says that if we just work in the eigenbasis of the state, you know, then you can compress down to now the von Neumann entropy. So of course, to make this all rigorous and, you know, prove things carefully, you know, you have to not just talk kind of waving your hands about typical, but you have to define a notion of epsilon typical. You have to say how much of the state lives in the epsilon typical subspace, and, you know, talk about how the fidelity goes to one and things like this. But I mean, this should give you kind of a rough outline of the main ideas. Yes. Well, that will never happen. If we're encoding qubits, you know, if we're encoding qubits, then we'll never need to send more than one qubit to send one qubit, right? I mean, you could always just not do any encoding and then just send every qubit in the clear.
In the theorem, we assume S is smaller than one, or?
Yeah, I guess S will be something which is in general less than one. Like, so for example, if the message is, you know, always, you know, 0, 0, 0, 0, right? Then the entropy will actually be 0 and you won't need to send anything. The worst case is where it's, you know, it's a fair coin flip. I'm talking now about the classical case, but you know, the worst case is where you have a fair coin flip, then the entropy will be 1 and you won't be able to compress at all. And if you're somewhere in between, you'll have an entropy which is between 0 and 1. Remember, the entropy is always between, you know, say if we talk about the von Neumann entropy, the entropy is always between 0 and log d. Right, so if we're talking about sending qubits, log d is 1. So the entropy is always between 0 and 1. If we're talking about, you know, qutrits, so we have three-level systems, then the entropy would be between 0 and log 3. And then this rate could be, you know, could be more than 1. But that's because we're talking about sending things using qubits. So, of course, to send qutrits, in the worst case, you might need more than a qubit for each one.
And so here we assume then that classically the string was, for example,
Okay.
Here we assume that then we want to send cats.
Say, if we want to send pure states, yeah.
And the cats, I mean, assume that they are, because can that, what if the example for example, has a mixed state, as rho being mixed
state? Yeah,
state,
could be.
But then psi I can, it's kind of arbitrary, so.
Psi I. Well, it's not arbitrary. I mean, they're the eigenvectors of the density matrix. I mean, it's true that the states that we think about encoding when we, you know, go through this process of thinking about just encoding the typical eigenvectors look very different than the states that could be given to us. But, you know, we're not just individually sending those states. I mean, what we're really doing is projecting onto the whole typical subspace. And the claim is that the density matrix, you know, when you take n large, you take, you know, any state that comes from this ensemble, it has a big projection onto the typical subspace. So when you project onto the typical subspace, you're not throwing much away. Yes. Sure. I'll try to do that. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Good. Other questions? Okay. So now let's go on and talk about error correction. So far, you know, we've talked about a situation. You could think about this, you know, where you have some data transmission problem, and you would like to compress your source down. But it's really important. Sorry. Go ahead.
In the diagonalization of rho, there's any degeneracy in an eigenvalue so that you can choose how you can choose two eigenvectors associated with that lambda?
Right.
Is that a problem?
No, it'll have just absolutely no effect. I mean, you could make any particular choice and it would be the same. I mean, you would get the same typical subspace and it just would have no effect on what you choose. Okay. Right. So I was just saying, you know, you could think about this in this problem. You could think about, you know, having some data that you want to send over a channel. But the reason that this is called the, you know, the noiseless coding theorem is that we're imagining that channel is a noiseless one. So it just acts as the identity. It just sends the state through perfectly. And we're asking how much we can compress things down in order to transmit information through a noiseless channel. But more generally, we could imagine that we have some noisy channel, and we want to figure out how to cope with that. And, you know, the means of trying to cope with that is what's called error correction. So error correction would be a way of trying to, you know, transmit information faithfully through a noisy channel. Or equivalently, you could think about it as a means of trying to store information if you say you have a noisy memory. So this is like trying to send information from the past to the future, you know, without losing the information. So this is so the goal here is to have reliable transmission. I'm writing small again, aren't I? Reliable transmission or storage in the presence of noise. Okay. So how are we going to do this? Well, the first thing we need to do certainly is have some kind of a model for the noise, and we need to understand what the how the noise is acting. So this is going to be a little bit more complicated in the quantum case. So let's start out with thinking about what happens in the classical case. We'll see a very basic classical error correcting code, and this will give us a bit of motivation for thinking about quantum error correcting codes, where there will be more details than what we have to think about in the classical case. Okay, so let's consider the classical case first. And then we need to have some kind of an error model. So let's, for simplicity, let's consider the following error model. We're going to consider what's called the binary symmetric channel. So our information will be encoded in bits. So our two possible bits that we might be trying to encode information in, the two possible values are 0 and 1. But the channel will, there will be some probability that the channel will introduce an error if we send a bit through the channel, or if we try to store the bit for some amount of time. So there's going to be a probability P that the bit is flipped. And that probability is the same depending upon whether the bit was initially 0 or 1. So that's the symmetric part of the binary symmetric channel. And then, of course, there's a probability 1 minus P that there's no error. So this is called the binary symmetric channel. So this is going to be the kind of error that we're going to assume for a single bit. And now, even more crucially, we have to say something about what's going to happen if we have many bits that we try to store. And so we're going to make the assumption that the errors are the same for all bits, and they're independent of each other. So we're going to assume IID errors. So of course, you're making quite an assumption when you say this. More generally, you could imagine, for example, that some correlated errors could happen if you have errors happening. Maybe there's some probability that exactly the same error happens on different bits in different parts of the system. And, in real systems, you might have to cope with things like that. And you can design error correcting codes to cope with situations like that. But, this is, again, like the simplest interesting case. So we're going to think about this case. Okay, so now we're going to assume we have IID errors. And now we might like to make some error correcting code which would allow us to send a bit reliably or more reliably than it would if we wouldn't encode it through a channel like this. Right? So we have this probability P of an error. So let's try to encode information so that we decrease the probability of error. I mean, of course, we can never, if there's some probability that an error occurs, we can never ensure that we can make things perfectly reliable, but we can always make things, very good in the asymptotic limit and things like this. Okay, so here's an example of a simple code. So the simplest way we might try to encode information so that it would be better protected against these kinds of errors would be to just store the information redundantly in other words, just to repeat the information. So just copy the information. So here's a simple code. This is called the 3-bit repetition code. So what we'll do is we'll encode the signal 0 into the string 000. So we might write that as logical 0, so 0 sub L. And we would encode the message 1 into the signal 111. So we would write this as 1 sub L. In other words, this is logical 1. And so these things are called code words. So the idea is that if you want to send the message either 0 or 1, instead you're going to send it redundantly. You're going to send one of the code words, either 000 or 111. And now there's redundancy in the message, and you might think that this would help to get the signal through more clearly. I mean, this is a lot like maybe what you would do on the telephone, right? If you're not sure that someone's going to hear you, you might repeat yourself. Okay, so now the question is, you know, what can we say, like, a little bit more formally about how well this code will protect information? Well, you know, now what we're going to consider is the possibility of errors happening on these bits. And so a 0 could be flipped to a 1, or a 1 could be flipped to a 0. But let's think about the case where the error probability p is small, right? I mean, of course, we won't be able to deal with arbitrary errors, so we're going to have to make some assumptions. So let's think about the case where p is small. So if p is small, then it's much more likely that we have, you know, if we have an error, that we have one error than that we have two errors, right? Because if p is small, we would need to have something that would happen with probability like p squared happen in order for there to be two bits that would flip. And notice that if only one bit flips, or if no bits flip, you can figure out what's really going on using majority voting, right? So what we can do is we can correct 0 or 1 errors by majority voting. Right, so we just look at, you know, are a majority of the bits 0 or are a majority of the bits 1? And that allows us to, you know, guess, under the assumption that it was more likely that few errors happened than that a lot of errors happened, what the original string actually was. And then we can decode, you know, we can reset the whatever bit didn't agree with the other two so that we go back to the good logical states. And now what is the probability that this is going to be successful? Well, you know, the probability that we have more errors than we can cope with, so 2 or 3 errors, is what? Well, so the probability that we have 2 errors is, the probability of any particular error on 2 bits would be like, so the probability of an error goes like, is p, so that would be p squared times 1 minus p, so that's the probability that we have no error on the third bit. And then, of course, there are 3 ways for this to happen, right? Because there are 3 bits that could be the bit on which the error doesn't occur, so there's some factor of 3. And the probability of having 3 errors is even smaller. That's like p cubed. Okay, so the point is just that this is big O of p squared. We think about the limit where p is small. So here the error is order p squared, whereas originally, if we didn't encode things, you know, we would have an error with probability p, which is order p. So we've improved the scaling of the error, right? So now we only have errors at one order higher. And so that's the sense in which we've done something better. If p is sufficiently small, then definitely it's advantageous to encode things in this way. OK, so this is really like the simplest classical error correcting code you could consider. There are many more sophisticated codes that, you know, maybe depending upon what p is, would encode things more efficiently, or perhaps would even cope with more sophisticated kinds of error models. But let's put that aside for now and go to the question which is maybe more interesting to us, which is how we would make a quantum code. Okay. Okay, so we want to somehow use these kinds of ideas in order to come up with some kind of a notion of a quantum error correcting code that we could use to encode quantum information redundantly and somehow be able to, you know, cope with errors that happen on our qubits. Okay, so I mean, it may seem like actually it's going to be hard to do this, right? And when people first thought about this, it wasn't obvious whether this would be possible at all because of a few problems. So first of all, we know that it's not possible to copy quantum information. So there's this no cloning theorem that says that we can't make copies of our quantum states. So the whole strategy here was based on repetition. We would just take whatever, you know, input state we had and make 3 copies of it. But we can't do that quantum mechanically. So we can't copy quantum information. So that seems like bad news for some kind of strategy based on repetition. So another problem is that, you know, in order to figure out what error happened to the system, we had to look at it, right? We had to see, you know, were there more zeros than ones? So we had to know, you know, whether the bits were zeros or ones. But quantum mechanically, we would like to be able to reliably send superpositions. We'd like to be able to send, you know, some superposition of 0 and 1 as some superposition of logical 0 and logical 1. But now we'll have to look at that in order to figure out whether an error happened. And we want to do that in a way that doesn't collapse the superposition. So I mean, this seems like another problem. So the measurement, or a measurement of an error, could disturb the state. And you know, as if that weren't bad enough, in the quantum case, we have a lot more errors that we have to correct for. So we have many, many more errors to correct. You know, in the classical case, we had this discrete set of errors that we wanted to try to correct. So for example, here we were trying to correct the case where we had no error. I mean, there you don't really have to do any correction, or where you have one error on any one of the bits. And that's just, four possible errors you might have to correct. But even if we thought about, say, some code that would encode a qubit into 3 qubits, now we already have a continuum of errors that we might have to correct for. We have to worry about all of those errors. But we also have to worry about small rotations about the x-axis instead of just the x-gate. We have to worry about rotations about the z-axis. I mean, in fact, rotations by any angle about any axis. And, we also have to worry about non-unitary errors, some quantum operation that's applied to the system. So there's just a huge family of things that we might have to correct against. Remember, already when we talked about the quantum operations that could be applied on the qubit, there were many different kinds of things that could happen just as examples of quantum operations. There was the depolarizing channel, phase damping, amplitude damping, all with different parameters. And there are many, many other kinds of quantum operations. So, it seems kind of hopeless if you have to sort of think about this whole library of all these different kinds of errors you might have to correct. So it seems quite daunting. Until you see how it actually works, and you find out it's actually not so bad. Okay, so we have to somehow cope with all of these problems. So to make things a little bit simpler, let's first just worry about the first two. Okay, so let's say we don't worry about the fact that we have many, many errors to correct. Let's say all we want to do is be able to correct bit flip errors, where we could have a 0 being flipped to a 1. So we're going to consider a quantum analog of this binary symmetric channel, where we just apply an X gate with probability P, and with probability 1 minus P, we apply an identity gate. This is some quantum error model that we might want to try to correct against, but we might want to consider the case where we truly want to send quantum superpositions, over a channel which has this behavior. So we still have this problem that we can't copy quantum information and that we have to worry about how we would measure the error. Even in the case where, in some sense, the errors are occurring in the computational basis, we still might have states to send that are not necessarily in the computational basis. Okay, so let's first consider a code for bit flip errors. Okay, so first of all, how are we going to encode the state? Well, what we can do is we can't just make 3 copies of psi if we're given psi, but at least for now, we only want to correct against bit flip errors, so we only have to store redundantly the information about whether we're 0 or 1. We don't have to store any phase information redundantly. So what we can do is we can just copy the quantum information using this reversible quantum copying, in other words, using C0 gates. So for this first problem, we're just going to use reversible copying in the computational basis. Because that's the basis in which we want to correct errors, after all. So in other words, our encoding circuit will look like the following. So we'll again just define a 3-bit quantum code. And it will go like this. So we have some unknown input state psi, which could be any superposition of 0 and 1. And then we'll have some ancilla bits that start out in the state 0. And then we'll just reversibly copy the information about which computational basis state psi is in into these two other bits. So what's going to happen is that if psi is in the state alpha 0 plus beta 1, then this will get mapped to the state alpha 0, 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, 1, which we might write as alpha 0 logical plus beta 1 logical. In other words, the logical basis states will just be the states 0, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1. And now it looks like we're just doing what we did before, but we're putting kets around everything. But at least so far, we have maintained some information about superpositions. So this is sort of OK. All right, questions at this point? OK, so now we have to deal with problem two, that you know, suppose we have some state like this, and now an error occurs. And you know, with reasonably high probability, if an error occurs with this error model, it will only affect one of the qubits. So now we have to figure out how to decode the state without, you know, without destroying it. So we want to be able to get back the state alpha 0, 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, 1. And we want to do this you know, in a coherent way. So we can't just go in and look at, you know, do we have 0, 0, 0? Do we have, say, 0, 0, 0 or 0, 0, 1 or you know, any of the possible states where we would have one error occurring? And then fix that error, because that would collapse the superposition between 0, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1. But the strategy here is that what we're going to do is measure just the error. So we're going to perform some partial measurement, which will only tell us what error occurred, but will not distinguish between the different terms of the superposition. So for this problem two, kind of the slogan is that what we want to do is measure the error and not the data. So we can draw a circuit which will do this in this case. So now we have our three you know, physical qubits that encode this one logical qubit. And now what we're going to do is we're going to write some information in two other bits that will tell us something about what error occurred. And the idea is that what we want to do is only compute the parities of pairs of bits. Because notice that in the good states, in correct logical states, the parity of any pair of bits should be zero, right? We should either have two zeros or two ones. So we should have even parity. And so if we see that we have odd parity, that indicates that some kind of an error occurred. But if we're only measuring whether we have even or odd parity, that doesn't distinguish between here or here. And in fact, you know, if an error occurs, say, on the first bit, it occurs to the first bit, of course, in both terms of the superposition. So you know, the parity would be consistent between the two terms. OK, so here's what we're going to do. So let's, in this ancilla bit, let's write the parity of the first two bits, like this. And then in the next ancilla bit, we'll write the parity of the second and third bits. Oops, sorry. Okay, so this and this. Right, so now here what we have is the parity of bits 1 and 2. And I can't draw this morning, sorry. And here what we have is the parity of bits 2 and 3. Right? So now the circuit to measure the error will consist of doing these controlled NOT gates and then only measuring these two bits. And now under the assumption that at most one error occurred, we can make a table of the, you know, how the measurement outcomes down here tell us actually what error occurred. So not only can we detect whether there was an error, but we can actually figure out where the error was, and we can correct it. So you know, if we look here, there are four possibilities, right? We could get the outcome 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, or 1, 1. So of course, if we get the outcome 0, 0, that means that no error occurred, because you know, or it could mean that two errors occurred, but we're not trying to correct the case where there were two errors. So certainly, if no error occurred, if there were no bit flips, then we would get the parity of 0, because we just have this state. And so the parity is 0 for any of these pairs of bits. So this should indicate that there was no error. OK, so what about if we get the outcome 0, 1, meaning that we get 0 here and we get 1 here? So that should actually tell us on which bit an X error occurred. So can you see which one? If we get this outcome, which bit had an X error? Yes. That's right. Yeah, that's right. So I mean, notice that if there were if there was an error here, but not here or here, you know, that's going to flip both of the bits, because this is going to flip this, and this is going to flip this. So this 1, 1 corresponds to an error on 2, an error on bit 2. And so once you know that, well, the other ones must be 1 or 3. And it must be that this one had to do with bit 3, right? Because here we were you know, we have a 1 down here, so that must have come from this bit. At least that's the way that I would think about it. I don't know if that's the thought process you went through, but so this corresponds to an error on bit 3, and here we have an error on bit 1. Okay, good. So now we have a table that tells us, you know, depending upon which outcome we got when we made these particular measurements, what error occurred, and now we can go in and correct that error. And so if we correct that error, you know, we perform an X operation. Well, either we do nothing if we got this outcome, which is actually the most likely thing if P is small, or, you know, the next order thing that could happen is we get a 1-bit error, and so we're going to assume that that's the case when we have an error. So then this will tell us actually what to correct. So now, you know, what's going to happen is that if we actually perform that correction, the error in the state, which if we, you know, if we just apply this error model to this state, would be an error at order p, now becomes an error at order p squared for exactly the same, you know, kind of reason that we looked at over here. So this allows us to correct the error. So this lets us correct any bit flip error. So let me write x error because it corresponds to a poly x operator being applied on 1 bit. And there's a name for this, the result of this measurement that comes out that we'll be using again and again. This is called the error syndrome. So this is called the syndrome. So it's the thing that tells us what error occurred so that we can go and correct it. Okay, so this is, you know, nice, I guess. We have an error correcting code that can correct any, you know, any 1x error. But now we have to deal with the third problem, right? Because there are many, many more kinds of errors that could occur. And we have to somehow cope with all of them. Okay. So we have to somehow consider some kind of a quantum error model. Quantum error model. And think about, you know, how we could correct for all of these arbitrary quantum errors. Yes.
So when the error occurs.
Yes. Right.
I mean that, both 0, 0 and 1, 1, 1 have the
same bit. That's right. Yeah, if the error occurs, you know, on the second bit, then that would take, that would just act as, you know, I tensor X tensor I on the state, and that would send this to alpha 0, 1, 0 plus beta 1, 0, 1. Right. So then,
is there any, like, the error that 0, 0, 0 remain the same, but 1, 1, 1 becomes 1, 0?
Not an IID error. Right? I mean, if the error is occurring kind of independently and the same for all of the bits, then such a thing can't happen. Right? I mean, maybe there would be some non-IID error in which that would occur, but it would have to look at all of the bits in order to do something. Yes?
Could you say a few words about how recently parts of this were put together and by whom?
So basically, I mean, the kind of original idea that you can do quantum error correction is due to Peter Shor, who also discovered the factoring algorithm. So, you know, he wasn't satisfied to just show that you could factor numbers. Then he wanted to see that hopefully you could actually realize something like this in practice. How recently? I mean, it was done pretty soon after the factoring algorithm was discovered. So in the, you know, mid to late 1990s. Yeah. I guess really already in the, probably already in like 95, 96. Things like this were being done. So, you know, we'll see an error correcting code that will correct any error on a qubit, and this will be a code that encodes 1 qubit into 9 qubits, and this is called the Shor code because it was in this one of these early papers by Shor on quantum error correction. Okay, but so somehow we have to get our heads around what sorts of errors do we have to correct. So, you know, the most general error that we could consider on a qubit is, of course, some quantum operation. So we talked about, you know, quantum operations before, so we could have any trace-preserving, completely positive linear map on density matrices that would send a qubit to a qubit, and then we could make up an IID error model where, you know, this same operation would be applied on all of the qubits. And hopefully it would be an operation that's close to the identity if it's to be something that you could reasonably hope to correct, but, you know, it could be some completely arbitrary thing. Okay, so how are we going to deal with this? I mean, it's just, there's a vast space of parameters. Well, it turns out that you can really simplify things a lot if you think about it in the right way. And the way that helps to think about it is in terms of realizing this quantum operation in terms of an interaction between a system and an environment. So remember, we have this principle of purifying things, that we can always think about any quantum operation as being realized as some unitary interaction with an environment. So we're going to realize this by a unitary interaction with the environment. And so what would that look like? We could have, we're going to have a lot of parameters that we won't necessarily have control over. So we have different possibilities. So we could have, say, the state 0 for our system, and we'll always start our environment out in the state 0. Remember, you can realize this by unitary interaction with an environment that's prepared in some fixed pure state. So let's call that state 0. This is not necessarily a qubit. It could be some higher dimensional system. And then, you know, this could evolve unitarily. So this could map into any state of the form, you know, we could have some amplitude gamma 0, 0 to go to 0 for the system, 0 for the environment, plus gamma 0, 1, let me call it 1, 0, for 1 for the system, and, of course, in general, the system, the state of the environment will change, right? So let me just call this state phi 0, 0 for the environment. And then we have some amplitude 1, 0 to go into the state 1 for the system. And let me actually call this 0, 1 to go into the state 1 for the system. And then we'll go into some state phi 0, 1 for the environment. Okay, so this is just the most general general action of some unitary operation on an initial state that looks like this. Yes? Well, it's just notation. I don't know. These are just labels.
But I imagine that it's because it makes a message particularly clear.
I'm just writing 0, 1 because this is the amplitude that corresponds to starting in the state 0 for the system and then going into the state 1 for the system. That's it. That's all there is.
Okay. And why the pi?
Well, because the environment could be changed in some arbitrary way, right? Of course, we're doing something unitary, so when we expand this thing out, we can always write this as some pure state, but it could be a completely arbitrary state. And we don't even have to assume that the environment was a qubit, so it could be some 10-level system, and so this could be an arbitrary state of that 10-level system. Okay, so now if we start in the state 1 for the system and our standard initial state 0 for the environment, this could go into the state, this is what I'm going to call gamma 1, 0. This is the transition amplitude for going from 1 to 0 for the system. And then we'll have some state phi 1, 0 for the environment. And then we'll have, some arbitrary amplitude gamma 1, 1. Here we have 1 for the system and some state phi 1, 1 for the environment. Okay. So this is the most general thing that could happen. And somehow we want to be able to correct for this most general thing that could happen. So what turns out to be the case is that if we want to write what happens to a general initial state. So a general initial state would look like alpha, 0 for the system plus beta, 1 for the system, tensored with 0 for the environment. We could use these definitions and write out everything that happens over here in terms of these definitions. But then what we could do is we could actually rewrite the state in terms of different Pauli operators acting on the state of the system. This is actually quite similar to what happens when you analyze what goes on in quantum teleportation. I mean, here we have this more general unitary that's being applied, but there's a similar kind of principle that if you look at the states of the system that will arise over here, you can actually expand the states of the system that you see in terms of what happens with the identity, the x, the y, or the z operators acting on that state. Okay, so I think in the interest of time, I'm going to leave out the details of this calculation, but just say that you can write this as something of the form, some amplitude gamma I for the state psi, and then some state phi I for the environment. So this is for the system, for the environment. Then there'll be some amplitude to have an x applied, so x acting on psi s, and then there's some state phi x for the environment, plus some amplitude for, I think when I did this before, I just did it in terms of z and x times z. So let's just say z. So z acting on psi for the system, and then some state phi z for the environment, plus, and I guess I'll move this board up in a second so you'll be able to actually see it, but there'll be some amplitude for the operator XC to be applied to the system. So, you know, I guess I'll leave this as an exercise to work out what these things actually are, but I claim that there are some, you know, some amplitudes, gamma I, gamma X, gamma Z, and gamma XZ, which are just complex numbers, and some normalized quantum states, phi I, phi X, phi Z, and phi XZ, that just depend on these amplitudes, gamma 0, 0 through gamma 1, 1, and the states phi 0, 0 through phi 1. So you can rewrite the state like this. You can rewrite it as a linear combination of states where the state of the system is either the identity applied to the system, the X operator applied to the system, the Z operator applied to the system, or, well, up to some factor of I, just the Y operator applied to the system. Okay, so this is an exercise that you can go through, and if you just, you know, use those maps that I wrote out and then look for some way of, you know, just taking appropriate linear combinations, you'll find that you can write things like this. Okay, so this is really nice because this says that actually we only have to worry about correcting poly errors. Oh, you have a question?
Yeah. Would you mind repeating why we're considering X, Z instead of Y?
No, there's no reason. I mean, again, it's you know, if I wrote Y here and Y here, it would still be true because you would just have to there would be just some factor of I. I mean, if you actually go through the calculation, you'll find it's a little bit cleaner if you don't have to include this factor of I. You know, basically for the same reason that, like, when we talked about superdense coding, I used X, Z instead of Y. It keeps all the amplitudes real, but it's not. Just makes things a little bit simpler. It's not.
So the only difference is an I.
Yeah, just a factor of I. Just pushing a factor of I around. Okay, so now this is really nice because it says that we can effectively think about any error as being a poly error, right? So, so we can assume, or in other words, let me put it another way, if we can correct any poly error. So in other words, an error which is either I, X, Y, or Z, here I think of, I guess, the identity is like an honorary poly matrix, then we can correct any single qubit error. So, I mean, how can this be? This may still seem a little bit surprising because, you know, we have this possibility of, say, rotating by some small angle about some axis, and how are we getting the information that allows us to correct that? Sorry, just one second. So, you know, the way you should think about it is the following. So when we make a measurement of the syndrome that tells us what error occurred, we actually project ourselves onto one of these possible errors. So it's not that we couldn't have some error that would correspond to some small rotation. But when we measure the syndrome and that tells us what error occurred, of course the post-measurement state has to be consistent with the result that we got. So, you know, if we consider some small rotation, well, with large probability we'll see that the identity operation applied, we'll get the measurement outcome corresponding to that, and then we'll be projected onto the state in which that was the case. You know, there was no error that occurred, consistent with the result that we saw. And on the other hand, with some small probability, we'll project onto actually a large error occurring, but it'll be a large error that we know how to correct. Yeah.
At the bottom.
Yeah.
On the right hand side of that transformation, we have psi. Should I assume that psi is alpha 0 plus beta 1?
Yes, that's right. Sorry, I guess I should have written that.
Are we saying that any single qubit error can be a linear combination of results of acting with individual poly operators?
Well, not exactly. I mean, what we're saying is that for any single qubit error that might occur, the state of the system plus the environment is a linear combination of states in which the state of the system is either the identity applied to the original state, or X, or Z, or XZ. So, I mean, there's also this question about what's happening in the environment. Of course, we don't get to see what's happening in the environment, But when we make a measurement, which is going to tell us which of these errors occurred so that we can correct it, we'll actually project ourselves into a state where we have a tensor product with the environment, and so we don't care what's in the environment. Yeah. Okay, good. Other questions? Okay, so now we've really simplified the job that we have a lot, right? And this is really kind of a crucial observation, because before we had this huge, you know, very unwieldy set of errors that we might want to try to correct, and now we just have, you know, for a single qubit, we just have four errors, one of which is not even really an error that we have to correct. And in fact, for many codes, the way they work is that you basically have to correct, you know, sort of if they're treating x and z errors independently in some sense. If you can correct both x and z errors, while a y error is just a product of the two, and you know, so if they're being treated independently, then correcting x and z errors sometimes will actually also correct y errors. This is not always the case. So depending upon the design of the code, sometimes, and so in fact, you'll even have a problem, I think, where you're asked to find a code that will correct against x and z errors, but actually won't correct y errors. It's possible to do that. But if you design things in a certain way, actually you will also automatically correct the y errors. We'll see that in the example of the short code in just a moment. Okay, so now we basically have to correct against just these poly errors. So as a very simple warm-up, I guess the next thing we should do is see how we would make a code that would correct, instead of against x errors only, would correct against z errors only. But it's kind of very clear how you should do this. Basically, you should just go into the sort of transform between the computational basis and the basis of plus-minus states, the eigenstates of x. And if you do that, then you'll get a code that will correct against z errors, right? So to correct phase errors, or z errors, so phase flip, or z errors, which correspond to flipping the relative phase between the 0 state and the 1 state, because this is just the diagonal matrix with 1 minus 1 on the diagonal, what we can do is just Hadamard transform. Because, you know, the Hadamard gate is the thing that sends the x basis to the z basis, and vice versa. In other words, you know, HXH is just equal to z. So if we think about x errors and we want to turn them into z errors, we should just have them our transform. So here's what's called the phase flip code. Well, we'll just define it in terms of the logical basis states. We're going to encode 0 into the state, the 0 logical state, which will just be the state plus plus plus. So this is going to be 0 logical for this code. And we'll encode the original state 1 into the state minus minus minus. So this is 1 logical, where of course, you know, plus minus is the usual thing. This is 1 over root 2, 0 plus or minus 1. Yes?
All right, why do we bother decompose for representing z as a product?
I mean, I just write this to kind of remind you that h is the thing that transforms between the x and the z base. So, you know, the way you get from 0 to plus is apply Hadamard, and the reason for that is that H is exactly the thing that transforms the X basis into the Z basis. Okay, so these are our logical basis states for the phase flip code, and now what you can easily see is that if you encode an arbitrary superposition of 0 1, and 1 as a superposition of these states, then there'll be a way to correct any one Z error. So if on these three qubits you either have 0 errors or you have a z error acting on one of the three qubits, well, you can figure out where that error occurred by, you know, an analog of this circuit, except now you should be measuring in the in a different basis. You should apply Hadamard transforms to figure out whether you're in, you know, whether the parity is whether you have two plus or two minuses, or you have a plus minus and a minus plus. So you compute these sort of phase parities. And this will allow you to tell where a z error occurred, and then you can go in and correct it. Okay. So I think I want to actually at least tell you what the short code is before we finish. I mean, I realize we're sort of out of time, but I want to at least write down what the short code is, and then we can talk next time a little bit more about its properties, and we'll start to talk about kind of the general framework for more general error correcting codes, quantum error correcting codes. Okay, so what the short code does is it tries to correct against an arbitrary single qubit error, because, you know, of course, this thing protects against phase flip errors, But it gives us no protection at all against bit flip errors, right? Because a bit flip would take the plus state to the plus state. It just leaves it unchanged. And so that's going to be something that we're not going to be able to detect, right? It takes the plus state to the plus state. It takes the minus state to, well, it's going to give us a global phase of minus 1. And so we can actually have a logical error that occurs if we have an X operation occurring to one of these qubits. So what the idea of the Shor code, so the Shor 9-qubit code, what it does is it just combines these two codes. So it says, let's first encode things using the phase flip code. And then what we'll do is we'll take each of the states, which is a plus or a minus, and then we'll encode that using the bit flip code. And then we should have protection against both phase flip errors and bit flip errors. So what this is going to do is it's going to encode 0 into, well, so we're going to encode the plus state using the bit flip code. And so we're going to have, well, OK, so overall we're going to have some normalization factor of 1 over 2 root 2, because we're going to have three root 2s. And so the plus state is going to be encoded into 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, because that's what happens when you apply the repetition code to the plus state. And so we'll just get three copies of that. Okay? And similarly, the one state, so this is the logical zero state now of 9 qubits. And if we have the original one state, the unencoded one state, then we encode the minus state using this repetition code. So then we'll get 000 minus 111, 000 minus 111, 000 minus 111. OK, so clearly we haven't cloned anything. I mean, there's definitely a unitary operation that introduces some ancilla qubits and sends 0 to this and 1 to this. That's perfectly legitimate. But now we have some redundancy, certainly a lot of redundancy in the state, both in terms of bit flips and phase flips. And what you can show is that, in fact, if there's any one error, which is either an X, a Z, or in fact a Y, because effectively this code is treating the bit flips and the phase flips independently, you can actually figure out where it occurred, and you can go and correct it. Or rather, you can't necessarily figure out exactly where it occurred, but you can always correct it, right? So we have here this encoding of the bit flips, which is going to allow us. So so the outer code that we applied was the code that corrected against bit flip errors, and so we can go in and correct any one bit flip error actually on any of these blocks. So we could correct a bit flip error here, we could correct a bit flip error here, and we could correct a bit flip error here. So actually there are even more than just single qubit errors that we could correct. For example, we could correct a 3-qubit error if that error were an X here, an X here, and an X here. Okay, so that actually shows us that certainly we can correct against arbitrary single qubit bit flip errors. But then what happens with phase flip errors? Well, if we flip the phase actually of any of the 3 qubits within one of these blocks, it actually does the same thing to the state, right? It's going to change the phase in the same way, right? It's going to give us, it's going to turn this into a plus state, right? This minus sign will become a plus sign if we do a phase flip error on any of these 3 qubits. So any of those errors actually do the same thing. So we can't distinguish between those different errors, but that's fine because we would have to do the same correction to fix any of those 3 errors. So that's OK. So if we say, we get a state where this becomes 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, and then these two things are the same, then by measuring whether we have a plus or minus sign for each of the blocks, we can figure out where the phase error occurred, or at least in which block it occurred, and then we can go in and correct it. So that's how we correct the bit flip and the phase flip errors. And because they're corrected essentially, they can be corrected essentially independently, we can also correct the Y error. Y errors just by separately correcting X and Z errors, provided those errors happened on at most 1 qubit. Okay, so I think I'd better stop there.